I refuse to believe that we're getting fatter simply because we eat more. There has to be a conspiracy. Am I the only one who sees the dark hand of corporations? Thanks. I'm Nick Gillespie, and I'm very happy to be talking with Liz Williams, who is the founder and director of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum here in New Orleans. It's well worth checking out. Her writing is also widely published in a variety of places. Seek it out online and go to the Food and Beverage Museum's website for more information. Liz, before she was putting together the Food and Beverage Museum, was the president and CEO of the University of New Orleans Foundation, which is probably best known for the D-Day Museum, or certainly under your tenure, so, which was a long overdue, I think, honor. It's a curious thing how long it took the U.S. really to kind of commemorate World War II in terms of museums and things like that. Liz is a graduate. She's a Sicilian of Sicilian extraction, so don't make her angry. But she's a New Orleans native. She's a graduate of LSU, both as a BA and as a lawyer. And she served in the U.S. Army as a judge advocate general. And she's practiced law in Washington, D.C. and Louisiana. So please help me welcome Liz Williams to Reason Weekend.
Thank you.
I guess we're going to talk mostly about food and food policy, which is an important thing. But I guess, Liz, my first question for you, is it too late for me to go to law school? You've written that obesity has emerged as the primary domestic health problem of the new millennium, displacing smoking. How did this happen, and what are its likely effects on public policy, on legal issues, and on the food choices available to the typical American?
This is a big question. Yes, I think that we used to really care about smoking as the big issue, and it took many, many decades for that to end because people was just pushing and pushing and pushing to stop smoking and whatever. So I think the CDC had been finding that obesity was growing, that the size of people in the United States was growing. And I think, frankly, they needed a new issue. Mm-hmm. And so when they
saw... So this is kind of like when March of Dimes, when polio went away, they're like, okay, we're glomming onto birth defects.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Because if you don't have something to sort of be your banner, then you don't have any real way to be in front of the public.
I have to admit, then, that I am part of the problem because I'm giving with every year, I'm giving the CDC more to grab onto.
That's so, right. I think all of us are.
Yeah. Well, what is, can you kind of give us a horrifying tableau of what is the obesity issue that people are so upset about? I mean, what is there a quantifiable increase in the weight of Americans, and then that gets parlayed into a public health issue?
There is, but there has been good news since about 2003, 2004. Mm-hmm. Up until then, from the 70s to the area around 2003, the CDC was seeing real growth in the number of obese people.
And obese is a body mass index over 30.
That's right. Yep. And so if you look at what's happening now, though, that number has stopped growing. Mm-hmm. It has just remained flat since 2003. So we're talking about quite a while now where it has not been an increasing problem, but they haven't stopped sort of...
What have been the basic responses to this obesity epidemic?
Well, I think everyone is looking for a silver bullet. Mm-hmm. So you find all sorts of studies that make correlations between this thing and obesity, but I also think you can make correlations with other things. They've just cherry-picked things that seem to be either politically easy to do or make a good soundbite.
What do we know what's causing the, and I know in my personal life, but as a society, what goes into the weight increase, to the general weight increase of Americans?
I think that some of the studies which have looked at the number of calories people ate in, say, 1960 and the number of calories that people eat today show that on a daily basis we do eat more calories. Mm-hmm. And also, I think that we get less exercise.
Right.
We used to walk up steps, now we take elevators, you know, all sorts of things like that. So we eat more.
Okay. I refuse to believe that we're getting fatter simply because we eat more. There has to be a conspiracy. Am I the only one who sees the dark hand of corporations in all of this? And maybe the Bush administration, are they still in power? Can we blame this on them? Thank God we have a skinny president. Right?
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Who's very sympathetic to the problem, of
yes,
course.
Yes, that's right. And who has already helped to inculcate an eating disorder in his older daughter by saying, you know, there was a time when she was pretty chubby, but we took care of that.
Right.
That's very nice. You know, maybe that'll be the CDC's next mission, is going back to anorexia and bulimia, right? What are the basic public policy answers? We're all familiar with, you know, in the Nanny of the Month piece that Ted Ballacher and Alex Manning, who's here, and Adam Jensen helped put together every month. You know, we see the nanny state things like bans on salt, bans on, you know, fatty foods. What kind of effect will this have, if any, on food choices for Americans?
Well, I don't think it will have any effect. I mean, those are the things that I keep calling the silver bullets. We want some simple answer to a problem that people individually have to affect. Mm-hmm. And banning the food isn't going to make the choices any better for us. And
But it might make us slightly more miserable, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
So it'll, you know, there's that.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, if I wanted to eat too much oatmeal, I could get fat on oatmeal. And so I don't see how,
you know, it's
these...
interesting because behind the curtain, we have 6 pounds of oatmeal. This is Liz versus food.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not going to work. So this is actually, right. This is like a nightmare world where we just have nags and we still are all, you know, kind of Dom DeLuise sized.
And then there's still no overall look at the problem. Mm-hmm. Everyone just wants to find one simple thing and say, if we do this, the problem goes away. Let's just kind of wash our hands of it.
Are there, you know, and in terms of obesity versus being overweight, which would be a body mass index about between 25, and I'm sure, you know, we grew up in an age where you just looked at your weight and you pretended that you always had the heavy bone frame in the Metropolitan Life weight chart, but a body mass index is a way of calculating, you know, how heavy people are. And if you're over 30 on the body mass index, you don't have to know math, thankfully, to do this. You can go online and get it calculated for you. But basically, everybody in this room will be at least overweight, which is a body mass index of 25. And the rest of you can just go home now. Nobody wants to be around you if you're actually in the government targeted weight system. But
and you can be skinny and overweight, yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yes, no, that's actually true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the body mass index is a very flawed measure of just about anything. Mm-hmm. But are there serious health effects? I mean, if somebody is massively overweight, you know, there might be health effects. But, you know, if you have a body mass index of 27 or 29 or something like that, you know, is this... I mean, you know, there are two ways of looking at it. Is being overweight, you know, it might be an aesthetic issue, but is it a health issue? And then is it, you know, on top of that, is it something that the government should be addressing as opposed to, that's what boyfriends and girlfriends are for?
I think with just overweight, I think most people are just going to have whatever health issues they would have, and they're not related to being overweight. Although they do seem to find that if you are a yo-yo person who's constantly going up and down doing weird kinds of diets, that you might have some problems with that. But just being consistently overweight, that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
That's not something that causes lots and
lots
of problems.
I have to cancel that diet. I'm starting at the on Monday.
Right.
So
that's right.
Okay. Talk a little bit about, in some of your writing, you've talked about, and I'll butcher his name like I, you know, butcher my meat, Jean-Anthelme Briot-Savarin. Who is he, and why is he important to you and to contemporary debates about food nannies?
Well, he was a 19th century philosopher and a lawyer, by the way, and was a gastronome. And he really wrote a lot about French eating and talked about how if you were really a person who appreciated food, that you believed in balance, that you believed in not doing anything to excess, because you start to lose the pleasure when you do it to excess.
So, what a Frenchman.
Yeah. Right. So really what you had was somebody who had a philosophy about eating and a philosophy about food, even at a time that in France, haute cuisine was really developing and people were becoming very, very interested in eating. Mm-hmm.
And he's an interesting counterpoint then to contemporary food nannies who say, you know, under no circumstances, I mean, who demonize particular types of food rather than an overall diet.
That's right. I mean, even Julia Child was mm-hmm. one who said, it's balance, you know, don't say they're foods that you shouldn't ever eat.
Right.
Just eat whatever you eat in an intelligent way.
And she's also famous for saying, if you're afraid of butter, use cream, I think.
Right. Yeah,
but and she's a living example of somebody who obviously ate well, but also, you know, didn't end up, she's no Paul Prudhomme, right?
That's right.
Yeah, or
that's
Marta
right.
Vitale. You've written that you would support lawsuits against restaurants that provide 2,000 calorie meals without providing nutritional information, but that once the restaurants have posted that material, they should be free to sell meals, such meals, and people should be free to buy them. And you've written, by the way, Liz is a wonderful stylist. I really recommend reading her prose. Part of being free, you write, is the right to make unwise decisions. Now, to me, and I suspect to a lot of people in this room, this is totally sensible, eminently rational. Yet many individuals and many, if not most, legislators seem to disagree. And there are a lot of people who are like the smokers, and we've all known them, who cheered restrictions on smoking because they're saying, okay, that will get me to quit. How do we take your totally sensible position and make it, you know, not just a strong argument, but the winning argument in policy battles?
Well, I think that what you do is you look at the other side of what people are saying. They want to control everybody, but for example, those same people are not likely to want to control someone on food stamps who's making poor purchases. Mm-hmm. Because we could today, without any, I think, constitutional problems or whatever, restrict what we already do restrict what you can purchase with food stamps.
Right.
So if we decided to say, well, you can't buy potato chips and you can't buy candy bars and you can't buy, heaven forbid, sweetened beverages with food stamps, then people would be appalled that we were limiting the freedom of the people, these people who needed food stamps, and they should be able to buy whatever anyone else
right.
buys. Well, but yet we're willing to restrict everyone and say you can't, no one has access to these things. And I think that if you carry it to its extreme, then it brings to people the sensibilities of it. But then there are always those people who will never believe that they shouldn't be the arbiters of it all.
Right. You started the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in 2008 as a place, and I'm quoting from the mission statement, dedicated to the discovery, understanding, and celebration of the food, drink, and the related culture of the South. Why is it important to memorialize or to commemorate the history of food and drink? And what does it tell us about ourselves that it, you know, isn't accessible via other more standard historical channels?
Well, first of all, it is something that everyone does.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, the whole world has developed a culture around the way they eat and associates food with different kinds of celebrations or times of sadness or whatever. So it gives you a way to see people doing something that we all do, and that gives us a kind of a even playing field. It's an ability to relate in ways that you can't just do by looking at economics or something like
and
that.
And I have to say, if the museum visits are like my old family holiday meals, people would walk through it in 15 minutes and then argue for 2 hours. I don't know, but... talk about regional differences, because it is the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, and you know, what's the essence of Southern food culture for you? Is there an animating spirit that pulls it all together? Because certainly New Orleans has an incredibly rich and wonderful food culture. And is that the same as, you know, kind of low country or Georgia or, you know, Western Virginia? Or, you know, what pulls it together?
Well, mostly it's just geography, because mm-hmm. I think you bring a bunch of Southern scholars in here, and they yeah. would argue forever that there's no monolithic South.
Right.
So I don't think that you can say this runs through it, except that there's a lot of grease, there's a lot of pork, and corn.
Right. Okay. And corn pone, right?
Yeah.
Yes. As the grandchild of Irish and Italian immigrants, I grew up being exposed to all sorts of food that I took to be absolutely disgusting, you know, from a head cheese to tripe to kidneys. I always am thankful to food because it gave me one more way of resenting my parents. And I was thinking about this as I was preparing to talk with you. You know, many traditional insults, and certainly many in my childhood house, were food-based. Catholics in particular, and I think we share a Catholic heritage, were called mackerel snappers. For instance, and Italians as garlic eaters. There's a great scene, particularly if you're Italian-American, in the wonderful It's a Wonderful Life movie, where Mr. Potter asked Jimmy Stewart, after he's been accused of bank fraud, you know, where are your garlic eaters now, the people that he had helped build houses? Is food a divisive force, or is it a uniting force? Or how does it go? Because, I mean, I don't know if anybody has gone to food over, a plate of tripe. But, how does food work to divide us or to unite us?
Well, I think it obviously does both, just about everything. Yeah. Certainly, especially if you are very wrapped up in your own identity and your own food identity, you are going to find food that other people eat other. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to define yourself by your food. And for example, I think that in the founding fathers, a lot of people died in the colonies because they wouldn't eat the food that the Native Americans were mm-hmm. eating. And they would rather starve because they were English, and that was what you did.
Right.
But on the other hand, I think...
You have to admire that, standing
that's
by your
right,
principle.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. But on the other hand, food can be community, yep. it can be hospitality, mm-hmm. it can be a way to explore new things. So I think it's both.
And it is genuinely fascinating to me how in many places where... If you take the building block of what is considered a national cuisine, oftentimes it's an import. So, for instance, potatoes in Europe, or white mm-hmm. potatoes from the New World, or tomatoes in Italian cooking, which is, I mean, they only really started cooking with them in the 19th century,
right.
I think.
So right.
you have this entire building block of a national identity, which is very strong, and it's actually, an act of trade or globalization.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
mm-hmm.
At Reason, we spend a lot of time talking about various forms of freedom. Political freedom, economic freedom, freedom of speech. Lately we've been spending, partly because it is a real assault on basic choice, competition, things like that. We spent a lot of time talking about what we call culinary freedom. We live in a paradoxical age, and this picks up on some of the comments that Matt and I made last night, where you go to the crummiest produce section in the crummiest supermarket is likely now to have 10 types of lettuce, 5 types of potatoes, 3 types of eggplants. I mean, it just goes on and on. Yet whole cities have banned trans fat, cheap restaurants, even salt, or have tried to. So what's going on here? How do we make sense of this bizarre paradox where, on the one hand, we have more and more options at our fingertips at every level? I mean, in my small town in Ohio that I live in, the Kroger department grocery store just expanded, and they now have 2 sushi chefs. Working in a small town outside of Cincinnati, and it's pretty good sushi. Mm-hmm. you have that on one hand, and then on the other hand, you have Mike Bloomberg banning salt or council members in LA banning fast food restaurants from whole areas of the city. What's going on here? How do we make sense of this strange, seemingly strange paradox?
Well, I don't even claim to be able to make sense of it. I mean, mm-hmm. I really do believe that it goes back to this whole silver bullet idea mm-hmm. where somebody gets in their minds the idea that this is going to be better for everyone, this is going to solve all sorts of problems. So we'll use the mantle of public health to be mm-hmm. able to push something through. At the same time, we have free enterprise, and people are showing at the marketplace that they want 10 kinds of lettuce and they right. want sushi sushi chefs.
Okay, we're going to ask you to repeat that five
yeah,
times.
Yeah, I appreciate so that.
So, are you heartened? I mean, you must be heartened as a person who's interested in food and like the legal ramifications of food policy, but also cooking and whatnot. I mean, we are just in this explosive era mm-hmm. of over mm-hmm. the past 10, 15, 20 years. I mean, yeah. do you see any? Will the nags be able? I mean, they'll be able to annoy us, but will they be able to keep us from eating what we want?
I don't really think they're going to be able to. I mean, Hardee's made this food thing that was like this big, you know, and they actually marketed it by saying, nobody's going to tell me what I can eat. And people would go in and they would buy this instead of lettuce or whatever. And I think that that's going to prevail because it's so basic. Everyone eats every day. I think you can argue, for example, about smoking. You can live without smoking,
right.
But you cannot live without eating. So the control of food is on a totally different level than the control of something that you can live without.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, prohibition didn't work. And the people continued to speak and simply disregard the law. And I think that, you know, it would be a really horrible to make all the eating of these foods a crime or the selling of some of these things a crime. But it's going to continue to happen. People are going to cross the state line or they're going to get it over the internet or they're going to do it whatever they want. I mean, look at the banning of foie gras in Chicago. That wasn't very successful. And it was something that was done for not even reasons that made sense, and yet it was an easy thing to do. And of course, you can look at the way cattle is slaughtered in the big slaughterhouses that go into all of the fast food industry, and the poor civil rights, animal rights activists who are worried about foie gras aren't even addressing some of those questions because they don't want to fight the big producers. So here they these are probably people who want to support small farms. At the same time, they're killing them by banning foie gras. So none of it makes sense. There's no rationality to it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what I'm getting from that is I really hope we're having foie gras for lunch. I'm not sure if we are. A foie gras po' boy would be...
That would be very good.
Let's open it up for questions to talk about...
All right.
I'm just wondering, with this new fabulous health care act that we have, are people going to be able to use that? I mean, that's the kind of scary thing, like you are now becoming unhealthy, and so therefore we have the legal clout to tell you what to eat and what not to eat, because now we're having to all pick up the freight, so to speak, of health care. Could you comment on that, please?
Well, I think that the thing that may protect us in that area is that if you look at the statistics of who is overweight and who is obese and the largest number of people, you will find that obesity is really an issue of poverty and lack of education. And so I think that if you started to tell people who were in poverty what to eat, that you would have civil rights issues that would be greater than telling other people what to eat. So I think that it may wind up being its own check.
Then this, I mean, you know, that's
always... That's a cynical perspective.
That's always the question. You know, and I always find that's a standing argument against socializing or taking... things and putting them in the public sector, because all of a sudden then, you know, a million people to get to vote on your lifestyle choices. And that's actually, I think, the beginning of a pushback against a lot of this, that, you know, you don't, you know, because then, you know, by rights under this, we've already got half of the healthcare system is in the government sector anyway, I mean, or money anyway, but, you know, we should ban motorcycles, we should ban skiing, we should ban all sorts of activities that are high-risk activities if you're going to pick up the tab. And that's actually a very good argument for getting the government out of these choices.
Thank you. you know, kind of in the ongoing effort to make public schools the joy, grim places that they can be for kids, that seems to be kind of one of the first fronts with this obesity effort. So, like, in California, where I live, my kids every year, they send home, like, a BMI, like, body fat mass report to me, which somehow doesn't stop my 14-year-old son from having three dinners and eating eight boxes of cereal a week. But I guess my point with all of this is, you know, you see the movement where they're going to turn school, the National School Lunch Program, which is, you know, a huge waste of money, they're going to make that into a Whole Foods effort where, you know, they're going to basically spend 3 to 5 times as much per unit costs on school lunch to have healthy choices that, you know, will force kids to go to Del Taco after school. And, you know, can you kind of comment on really these efforts to manage weight through the public school system or what you think of that or where that might be going?
Well, I think that if you're going to manage weight through the public school system, then you want to have physical activity. You want to encourage after-school activities that make people move, as opposed to controlling people's food.
So I mean, you're calling for a return to child labor, then?
That's right, absolutely.
Get these kids working.
That's right. Give them something to do. I mean, I think I think we were all children. We remember that the more you tell us we can't do something, the more we want to do it. So it just doesn't seem like the way to do it. If you made some of the choices maybe more attractive, that would work.
I wonder if this could open up a whole new type of charter school. Right, I mean, where you go there, you pick it based on the lunches or something like that. One of the things we were going to talk about is, you know, this isn't the, I mean, food is always it's a battleground. I mean, you know this if you're a parent and you're trying to get your kid to eat mashed peas or whatever. I mean, but socially it has been. And one of the fascinating kind of chapters of American history is, between 1880 and about 1925, 1930, there was a huge wave of immigration from Europe. There were massive attempts, both private and public, to Americanize these immigrants who came from southern, central, and kind of Western Europe, Ireland, and whatnot, and to try and get them to eat American and to eat proper foods. And people like Henry Ford privately funded this. Various cities had things where they would try to teach immigrants to stop cooking everything in the same pot, to put food on the plate so that the protein and the vegetable and the starch didn't touch each other, because they were instructed that, you know, these things shouldn't mingle. You know, there's like no, I mean, food has always been a battleground, and I think it will continue to be. And what's curious is that, I think both among the lower classes, or as, you know, they used to be called the lower orders now, there's much more of a sense, not simply of entitlement, but also of empowerment, of, you know, don't tell me what to do. And that runs through all of American society. And hopefully we're getting to a point where, maybe from revolt over school lunches, more freedom will flow, and not just more obesity.
Fannie Farmer said that that garlic and hot sauce both were things that would reduce people's morals, and therefore it was very important not to eat either one of those things.
You mentioned that obesity was primarily a poverty issue. If you isolated the poverty element, what would the trend be based on the data you said earlier, where you had increasing obesity and then it leveled off?
I think that the leveling off is still happening in all areas. So I think it's across the board. Oh, well, there's still a growth in overweight and obesity, but it's not as big.
Right, and it's, also, I mean, people are bigger now.
That's
In terms of, because of better nutrition, I mean, we're taller, and heavier in general. Mm-hmm. So,
but even looking at BMI, right. There is still an increase. Yeah.
Up on what Nick answered quickly,
assuming we do not succeed in getting rid of the health care bill, I'd be interested in a little more speculation as to what the effect of that is likely to be, because it obviously is going to create a huge argument that I've not had before for saying, well, gee, you know, I have to pay for your health bills, therefore, et cetera.
Liz, I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about it. I mean, we have examples of this throughout various European countries as well as Canada. And I don't, on the face of that, they have not necessarily been more invasive as a result of that. By the same token, those countries, ironically, even though they might be more socialistic in certain elements, they also have, France is a good example, where they have a very strong, tradition of public sector spending and also a private privilege or a private license and liberty, so which we don't have in America. And I think, America has always been more kind of individualistic and small government, but has also been much more nannyish. And England might be the example that's closest to us. And you do see there a lot of, England is the most surveilled nation in the world. I mean, I think they're right up there with North Korea in terms of peeking in on their people, through surveillance cameras, through all sorts of government programs. Jamie Oliver, who might be the single embodiment of the nanny nudge, who wants to move into the nanny state, created a school lunch program in England that was wildly expensive and wildly unpopular and wildly unsuccessful in all of its aims, and he's trying to export it to West Virginia right now. I mean, he's got a TV show called Jamie Oliver's Food Revolution, so.
Yeah.
What do you think about air conditioning and TV as being contributing factors to obesity, and ethnic groups that I know tend to have obesity in their families more so than they're not poverty, they're not people that are in poverty.
Ethnic groups like Burl Ives. my Italian side's from outside of Naples.
No, I have Syrian. I have Syrian friends, and they're all really overweight and obese. Some of them are even really obese. I mean, but I think back when I was a kid, which was forever ago, we played outside all the time. We ran, and you couldn't possibly gain weight. I don't care how much you ate.
Well, if you asked me to put together some sort of overall statement of all the things that contributed to this obesity sort of rise, which I think, fortunately for all of us, it's sort of leveled off, so we can at least not have to deal with a lot of the worries about it that, crazies will have. But, I mean, I would go back to school busing, where people can't play with their friends after school because they've been bused across town, and they don't know anybody in their neighborhood. And video games, computers, maybe a rise in crime where people don't feel comfortable letting their kids play outside all the time. I mean, I think you could come up with all sorts of things that aren't even related to food that have attributed to that. Yeah. And then I would even point to things like, why do we have snack in school? I don't know how many people here grew up without snack in school. And then you came to a point where people decided that you needed to control the children by having snack, maybe, instead of recess or whatever.
Or corporal punishment.
And so people are encouraged to eat all the time. I mean, there are all sorts of things that you can that you can point to. I don't think there's just one thing. And with Syrian people, maybe it's cultural that people think that this is more attractive. I mean, we've made our own definition of what is overweight or obese, and,
Well, and, just to speak very quickly to the point of kind of national or ethnic culture and weights and things like that, there's Herman Melville was a seaman, a sailor, and he wrote a bunch of adventure books, and he went out to, at one point he went through Samoa in the 19th century, and he remarked on how they were the skinniest people he had ever seen, and they were a race of skinny people. And, the only time you see Samoans now are in professional wrestling and on football teams, and basically within you know, 50 years, you can transform from being the skinniest people in the world to somehow being the fattest. And I mean, I know, you know, this kind of natural experiment with my grandparents and my parents' generation. My grandparents were all born on farms in Europe, and they were all skinny, and all of their kids were both taller than them and about 50% heavier. And, you know, so I mean, the environment really makes a big difference.
As you know, I'm from Europe, and when I had my first American breakfast experience in here, I was shocked. I thought they eat like farmers would eat when they have to walk 5 miles to the field and then work all day in the field, and you still have this kind of breakfast in the U.S.
And high-speed rail is all.
Yes, but then, no. But then you sit in a car, you go in an elevator, you sit at your desk all day, and... Well, I always like the analogy of a grapefruit for your stomach. That is the size of a normal human stomach. It's a grapefruit. But it's not like the... If you overfill the tank of your car, it just overflows. But your grapefruit is expandable. You can put as much food in it as you want. I've never seen a place in Europe where you sell as much antacid, Gaviscon, or whatever you call it. First time I had a minor indigestion in the U.S., it was, oh, here... drink this, and it's pink, whatever stuff. In Europe, I never have indigestions because they don't add as many things to a food. It's simpler,
so
more basic.
So you came here for the economic opportunity? But
no, I came here because I love America. Okay. But I'm shocked to see what you're doing, what Americans are doing to themselves. And I had a 12-year-old niece, and Rebecca might remember her, who was a size 22X. She was American, and she stayed with us for about 6 weeks, and in 6 weeks, she went down to a size 12 on normal food, what I call normal, which is my French food, and just normal exercising.
I want to speak for Liz, but I actually saw it as an incredible immigrant success story that my parents were, you know, 100 pounds heavier than their parents. That's, to me, that's part of the American dream, is that, you know, your children will be heavier than you. That's,
One last question here. Okay.
Thanks, Amy. Kind of getting to the nanny state part of the talk, in a lot of things, food being one of them, but Nick mentioned motorcycle riding, especially motorcycle riding without helmets, for example. Clearly, I think the free market sort of response to a lot of the risky things that we might enjoy doing, including, you know, eating or smoking and whatnot, is the coupling of what we do with responsibility and also having the insurance, health insurance, life insurance, disability insurance, all those kinds of things paid for by ourselves. And if we put ourselves into a high risk category, like we ride motorcycles without helmets or something like that, we should be allowed to do it. We just need to have that know that we're in the high risk and so forth. So I wondered, Liz, if you could comment on the coupling of the anti-nanny state, which I would agree in, but also the importance of responsibility.
Well, if schools or parents or whatever have anything to say about these things, to me that's really the most important thing, is to not just lecture about responsibility, but just act in a way that makes children learn that responsibility is the way to go. And so I think that we often don't, as for example, support school systems that have things that give people the skills to make intelligent decisions for themselves. So then you'll have a school system that says, oh, I need more money for PE programs or whatever, so I'm going to let Coca-Cola give us this much money so we can have a Coca-Cola machine in our school. So it's easy for somebody to target that machine and say, we're going to ban those and not let those be there, instead of looking at, well, maybe you should be funding certain basic curriculum things that are being eliminated. I don't think anybody looks at all of the pieces of what they're, you know, the unintended consequences of what they're doing. But I mean, I agree with you. I think that letting people have enough in enough rope to make choices and then learn from their choices is the way children need to be inculcated in personal responsibility.
And I think that on a broader level, the main point that you're bringing is, you know, we are going through at various points attempts to de-link behavior and outcomes, and how do you deal with that? And you know, in the mortgage market, in the banking industry, where it doesn't matter what loans you write or what loans you take on, you know, you won't be held responsible. And you know, that to me, in a lot of ways, part of the debate over healthcare reform comes down to something like that, where it's, you know, you can't know the costs of your choices if those costs are being hidden from you. You know, and you might know the opportunities, and that it's a dynamic which is really at the core of a free enterprise system, but also I think an individualist view of the world. And to the extent that we muffle those indicators, you know, we're starving ourselves of the very information by which we can make the best informed decisions. So, well, I want to thank Liz Williams for talking to us. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.